I really envy anybody who has a good radio voice.
Yeah.
Because I don't. I have this, like, annoying kind of tenor. So maybe if we get that mixing board, I'll rework it so I just put as much bass in my voice as possible.
I don't care.
And then when we all get a cold, we sound like some badass cowboy.
Yeah.
Hello. You're like, why can't I have this magic power forever?
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from Garden Grove, California, you are Cassidy Robinson.
I am. And today, another guest. Another week, another guest. We have your friend over from Portland, Matt Grigsby.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. And just a little background, you are an illustrator.
I am, yes. I do comic books and character designs for animation and video games.
That's awesome.
Yes.
So you pretty much are living the dream.
Not yet. I'm working on it. I'm hopefully going LA bound in the next year or two, so we'll see how that goes.
Oh, good luck with that.
Thank you.
I've been here not even a year, and I already, like, hate going to LA.
Yeah, it's pretty much the worst. It just smells like butt, and it's hot all the time, so.
And everything's too small. Nothing is the right proportion for how many people there are.
Exactly, and it's spread out, and it's incredibly expensive.
Well, yes, that as well. But, I mean, like, the streets are too small. I just hit my computer really violently. That's how upset I am about this. The streets are too small. The parking lots are definitely too small. And they don't have turn lanes. They don't have turn lanes.
No, and it's really bizarre. And they have these, like, road signs when you're trying to park that looks like a medieval scroll that's been stretched out and just stapled on to a street post. It's amazing. It's like, you can park here from 9 to 2 on this day, but not this day. And then on this day, you can be here from this time to this time. And you're like, I don't understand.
Yeah, it's the worst. But, good luck with all of that. And you are a very talented illustrator. Richard,
thank you.
Linked me to some of your work, and I was able to take a look at it. And you're going to be here today specifically because we'll be reviewing X-Men Days of Future Past, and you are purportedly a very big X-Men fan.
I am a huge X-junkie, so I'm very happy to be here today.
All right, because we're gonna get into it with that review.
Right on.
Cool. And Richard, what have you been up to?
Nothing. I don't do stuff with my life. No, I don't
you
know.
You told me, the last time we talked, you told me that you were going to be taking an internet class.
Oh, I did. I am doing that. Yeah. That happened. I signed up for it.
What is... Explain to me. What is this? Why? What's happening?
Well, it's a horror writing class. They get horror writers and they tell you about horror writing and you write about it.
That's... I don't think you told me that.
Did I not?
No.
I don't know. I don't know what I do with my life and my time.
Which school?
It's not a school. It's called Lit Reactor.
Oh, okay.
It's a online community for writers trying to get into the industry, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, cool. It's pretty... So, no, it looks like it's pretty cool.
But you'll be able to, like, critique each other's work and kind of, like, have workshop and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, there'll be a small workshop portion, and then there are four different people who are coming on for four different weeks, and yeah, it's just a small class to hone my craft, mm-hmm. become a better writer.
Well, that'll be cool. I mean, I think that's sort of the key to being able to get better, is to have an incentive. And when you know your stuff is going to be read and critiqued the next week, it kind of forces production.
Well, yeah. Right now, well, I was telling him, I actually did last night. It's good for me, like, actually. Like, I'm not a quick writer. I need to get better on pacing.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote about 1,500 words last night, and it's like the most hardcore thing I've ever written, and so it kind of grossed me the fuck out. So
you surprised yourself yet again.
I
to the depths of your perversion.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm a deviant.
For you, like being a night owl, that's just that's like your work day. But
yeah,
we usually when I'm up till about 4 a.m. and I'm working on something, that's when the weird stuff starts happening. Where you're just like, yeah. Wow, why is everything so weird right now?
Yeah, no, the weird stuff is just my life.
yeah, pretty much.
And I'm finally done with school. My first year of grad school, last week specifically. Was rough. I still feel like I'm not completely over it. Like, I wake up and I'm like, oh, I have so much to do, and then I realize that I'm done. Because it's like just completely traumatized me.
Let's hear your workload. Let's hear it.
Well, it wasn't, I mean, it's mostly my fault because I put everything off to the last minute.
Okay, the truth was revealed. Keep going.
Yes, but basically I had, you know, 2 10-page papers and then 1 15-page paper that I had to do in the span of, like, about 10 days. Now, if you're interested in illustration and you're moving down to California, would you be interested in Disney? Because I know a lot of people get their feet wet there.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been a big Disney fan since I was a little kid. Oh. So.
Well, there you go. Yeah. A lot of the Orange County natives really resent Disney because it's, you know, it's like they're what they're known for. Like, I guess in the same way that me and Richard resent skinheads and potatoes.
Yeah, I could get... Well, Oregon has a lot of skinheads, too, so I resent them as well.
Good. That's probably the wise way to go.
Yes, absolutely.
On holding a position on skinheads. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get into our movie news. And Richard, I'll let you start.
Of course you do. Okay, so big, bad, sad news. Edgar Wright exits Marvel's Ant-Man as director. That's according purported to the Variety and a bunch of other sites. It's pretty legit. The rumor has it is that there was just discrepancies that the Marvel uppity-ups wanted to add stuff and
yeah,
so on and so forth. That is rumor. It's complete conjecture at this moment, but...
I heard I heard in an article from Badass Digest that it went above Kevin Feige. It was like it was the Disney side of the corporate battle that was trying to get Edgar Wright to change the screenplay at the last moment. And yeah, they wanted to kind of soften it and take out his idiosyncrasies and make it kind of more mainstream. And yeah, that's what made him jump off board right before production.
Yeah, I knew it wasn't Kevin Feige, because I knew they had a pretty good one, a pretty good relationship. And it also seemed like he fit in really well with Joss Whedon and James Gunn, so...
Yeah, and then Joss Whedon had that Twitter photo...
Yes, the solidarity with the ice cream. It was amazing.
Yeah, the Cornetto he had, like, lifted up, lit on fire in solidarity. So, I don't know. I mean, apparently things might be getting kind of a little bit more contentious over at the Disney Marvel monolith.
Yeah, that's one of those things, too, that you almost don't know about unless you're part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear the rumors and stuff like that, but you only can conjecture.
Well, and you know, with First Class, when that was coming out, even though it wasn't a Marvel Studios piece, it was still like they had I think they were pushing... was it Matthew Vaughn that wrote that one?
He co-wrote it, but they
fast-tracked that movie so quickly that they lost at least 4 to 6 weeks in editing and some other things. And so when you hear stories like that, you're just kind of like, well, no wonder somebody would want to walk away, because
yeah,
you're destroying a baby, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was the other day, I was hanging out with Brad and Amanda from the Quarter Life Crisis, and we were all talking about this, and they seem to think that now that Edgar Wright's not attached, that nobody's going to see this. Like, that was the only reason why anybody would care about Ant-Man. Do you think that's true, or do you think... Because I tend to believe that the Disney-Marvel monolith is... powerful enough, and they have enough of a marketing genius that they can make anybody go see anything.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I think people will take a chance on the Marvel brand still. However,
for the very least, to see how it connects.
From a film nerd perspective, though, I think that they're very correct. I think that was one of the main draws. In fact, it's probably been one of the most exciting... Well, Joss Whedon was there too, but I almost didn't believe Joss Whedon because he always got screwed over, so I thought they'd pull Avengers from him. even at the last second, they'd be like, yep, we're replacing him with Joe Johnston or some asshole like that. And so
John Turtletaub. Yeah. Well,
Paul Rudd has a pretty big pull too, so they'll still go see it for sure.
I think there are still factors. And they're all committed. None of those people can drop out now. You know, big surprise, you know. But I don't know. We'll see. I just keep crossing my fingers and hoping like something gets worked out and he comes back or it's something. But I mean, I'm not holding my breath. But yeah, no, for me personally as a film fan, not as a Marvel fan, mm-hmm. I'm very fucking disappointed. So
My first news story, Godzilla, which we reviewed last week, director Gareth Edwards is set to direct a Star Wars spinoff. And it shows here in my article that the writer of After Earth and Book of Eli is going to be penning the screenplay.
Okay.
I didn't see After Earth. I heard it was kind of...
After Earth, you know, for Shyamalan, he's really stayed... In my opinion, he stayed really close to source material. He didn't take any risks. It was actually... I actually sort of enjoyed it just because it was a really simple concept to execute, and I think it didn't try to go for a big twist, because you get the twist in the very beginning of the film. So,
yeah.
I actually enjoyed it.
So I'm guessing it's this Gary Whitta, or Gary Whitta, who's going to be the screenwriter instead of Shyamalan, or else they would just say M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, Book of Eli, I like for what it is. It's a little heavy-handed at parts, but aesthetically, I really like that movie.
Well, yeah, but you... Well, that could have been the whatever brothers, the...
Damn you. Damn Why would you make me have to think about that? The Hughes brothers.
Hughes, yeah, that's it.
But Gareth Edwards, Star Wars, you have any thoughts about that?
Depends on which one. I mean, they already talked about the...
Boba Fett.
Yeah, it could be Boba Fett, Han Solo. It could be a Jabba the Hutt movie. I don't know. What are they talking about? Are they talking about Rancor Goes Crazy in Tatooine? Like, I'd watch the shit out of that. I'd be into that.
Did you guys watch all of the Clone Wars series?
I didn't. Well, first of all, which one? The 2D animated one? By the guy who did Samurai Jack.
The 2D one is near and dear to my heart, but I'm talking about the 3D one that was on Cartoon Network forever.
No, I saw the pilot at Comic-Con way back in the day, and then I never caught the rest.
Yeah, you know, it starts pretty rough, and then it gets pretty solid mid-season, closer to the end, and then it rounds out pretty strong, but they have two characters in there, Ahsoka Tano and Asajj Ventress, who are both Jedi and former Sith, and... technically speaking, Clone Wars is canon in everything that they're putting out now, but there was no... Both of their storylines ended really mysteriously, so I'm still holding out hope that they might do a spinoff or something to bring them back into the fold, because they would mm-hmm. still technically be alive in that series. So,
those characters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a long shot, but it would be really interesting, because one of the... Ahsoka walked away from the Jedi Council and... She went off and did her own thing, but she's still out there in the universe, so...
Yeah. Well, I also read somewhere that J.J. Abrams, in his reboot, his new trilogy, or whatever it's going to be, doesn't want to use any of the compendium sources, whether it be comic book or novels. So I don't know if that also includes Clone Wars.
Clone Wars specifically isn't off. Yeah, it's part of the Lucasfilm like world. Mm. It is part of the canonized.
Because it takes place between episodes 2 and 3. Whereas like the Timothy Zahn series was the original 7, 8, 9, and they threw all of that out because that was expanded universe stuff. So
fair enough. I mean, I could see this being working out pretty well. I think Gareth Edwards is an interesting director. I've yet to see any movies from him that's really blown my mind. But I think
only done two.
Yeah, he's done one independent film and then one gigantic studio picture. So I'll be interested to see where he keeps going.
He really transferred into that pretty well, though. And I do accredit some of that being to Legendary. I think Legendary is a great studio that also is a good brand.
Yeah.
So I usually think, I mean, even like 42 or something like that, that came out last year, the Jackie Robinson movie, I think that was pretty tight. So from Gareth Edwards specifically, I think it depends. I think he is a young director that needs a guiding hand, but he has shown that he can wrangle in a blockbuster, at least in my eyes. So
yeah,
it all depends on the character. I have no idea what they're going to do. So to me, this is still like, okay, he's going to do a character sweet. Like, is there going to be big monsters in it? What are they going to do? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. What's your other news story?
My other news story is Mr. Alfonso Cuarón. Mm-hmm. Is there one of the rumored next projects, because there's been like 20, is that he'll be doing a prequel to The Shining.
Yeah, this is hardcore rumor mill.
Yeah, this, oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, there was also for a while that they were, whether he was in talks with J.K. Rowling about doing like one of the follow-up series to Harry Potter, but that just got debunked.
That side book that came out just recently. Yeah, yeah, he I also heard about that.
The other thing is the thing that is true is Alfonso Cuarón said he thinks the next thing he will do is a horror movie.
Okay, so that kind of aligns with this a little.
Yeah, I was excited. I think his just basically his look of film would lend really, really well to horror, especially. I mean, thinking about Children of Men. Well, I mean, even Gravity has that great pacing for it. So
I've always been blown away with his cinematography skills and everything, and the fact that he does those continuous shots in every movie that last forever.
Yeah.
So if he applied that into a darker context, I think that could be incredibly cool.
Yeah. Who is his DP? Do you know? I don't know his name right offhand.
Hell. Now I forgot.
Haha, your brain melted.
Yeah, because you asked me.
I know.
Hold on.
But you know, between even like Children of Men and Gravity, like among others, like he just has he can flare up that intensity that I really enjoy out of his film. So if he tackled horror, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, totally. And there's like this kind of resurgence interest in The Shining because Stephen King just wrote a book sequel to it called Mr. Sleep or Dr. Sleep. I think that Cuarón's kind of sensibility, his pacing and his use of tension would work really well. I just don't know what kind of story it would be. Would it be the story of the other housekeepers who go crazy? And how would it not just be kind of rinse and repeat?
Well, Brad mentioned in a post that it might be like the it might be like the plot to Better Off Dead.
Yeah.
And it'll be about a weekend ski trip.
So. Emmanuel Lubietzky. That's his DP, who also worked with Terrence Malick on his last couple films.
Oh, so yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's okay. Fairly talented.
I knew he was a bigger name.
Yeah.
Or a bigger DP.
Yeah.
I sound dirty when I say DP. I'm going to stop saying that.
That's all you. That's in your dirty, dirty head.
Yeah. I already said I'm a deviant. So, I also agree with you guys. I think that his sensibility would work really well because he's got that slow mechanical thing, mm-hmm. and that would actually work really well with a Kubrickian kind of
methodical.
That place shots and stuff like that. So,
I was thinking a little Hitchcock-esque too.
Oh fuck yeah! Alfonso Cuarón is I've been really into his work ever since I saw *Y tu mamá también*, and I think that he's. It was before that because I didn't know until afterwards and I connected all the movies, but the third Harry Potter movie is my favorite of that series. And same. I think it's because it's beautifully done. Not necessarily that it's the best adaptation or whatever that I hear a lot of people bitch about, but,
how the Harry Potter fans love to hate that movie.
If they do go back to the hotel though, it would be pretty rad to have them come and reshoot some more exterior shots at Timberline Lodge.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you guys are right there in next to the one they use in the movie.
Yeah, they're trying to get Goonies 2 off the ground as well. So
yeah, we went up there last year and we were I felt like kind of an idiot, but And I knew this going in, that the maze was not real. But when I went up there, I was really disappointed that there was no big hedge maze.
So. Yeah, well, I believe in The Shining, there's exteriors that were shot at the real hotel, then there's interiors that were shot at a different hotel, then there's True. Sets, and then there's the hedge maze, which was built. So it's really kind of cobbled together.
No, I knew this all going in. And then when I went into the hotel, I still knew that the interiors were shot in, like, Colorado.
Yeah.
I still walk in there and I go, this isn't like The Shining.
I know.
And
I was like, everybody does it. Everybody does it.
But, I mean, you know, even still, like, with his methodical shooting and cinematography and his long takes and all that, I think he would also want to differentiate it from Kubrick to a certain amount, or else people are just going to be playing the compare game the whole time, which right. is impossible not to.
No, it's true. It depends if you go. It depends what stylistic choices he, you know, because I mean we're talking about it, but I mean all these films, while they do have a very similar through line, I mean I would definitely say the tone of Y Tu Mama Tambien, Harry Potter, and Children of Men are very different. And
yeah, all three. Yeah.
So. So no, I could see this movie being very different for him. And the other thing too, which is really, I think is cool, is that he's really big friends with Guillermo del Toro and and that Iñárritu fellow. And so they always take a look at the film. So having somebody who already has really tested the grounds of horror quite a bit, Guillermo del Toro. I'm actually, the more I think about him doing a horror film, I mean, besides being a huge horror nerd, the more excited I get. So.
Cool. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get into the pet topic, and Matt, go ahead.
So, surprise just recently, with how many actual, like, superhero blockbusters and, you know, toy franchises and things being turned into films, you go to the theater, and you see everything that's coming out, and on the movie poster, there's this trope that's been happening for, I don't even know how many years now, but it's basically everything has a very similar visual aesthetic on each poster, mm-hmm. and it's usually a color shift from blue to orange,
mm-hmm.
floating heads,
yes,
and a like stainless steel scratched metal typeface,
uh-huh.
for everything. And I've actually looked into this, and there are countless websites that have ran off lists of just. Like movie poster tropes that have been out there, and it's becoming to me such a hollow way to advertise a movie that may actually be pretty good. And you know, after going down to San Diego Comic Con this last year and buying up some Pacific Rim posters from a company called Mondo, I'm seeing a lot of really capable, really fantastic illustrators and designers putting out posters that are hand-drawn or advertise the movie in a way that is incredibly artistic and clever and not just this phoned-in Hollywood poster. So.
Yeah. So you're, I guess you're asking a little bit about, like, advertising and illustration within blockbuster advertising?
Yeah, I mean, the three of us here and countless other people, we're all creative types, and when you're trying to digest a movie, like, I know for me, quite honestly, like Cabin in the Woods is a fantastic film, but I actually was staying away from it deliberately because of the trailer and because of the poster. The poster because it was falling into certain tropes, mm-hmm. and the trailer because I was really irritated that it was advertised as just this really like phoned-in teenage horror movie, but everybody was like, but that's the point. You know, you have to see the hidden stuff on the inside. I'm like, right, but if it's not grabbing me from the start, then I'm probably not going to give the money away to see it. I don't know.
Yeah,
that one didn't bother me as much. Just I liked the cabin, like that was all twisted.
It was cool.
That part was fine.
Rubik's Cube cabin. Like
when we were talking, I was thinking, the first thing that came to mind when you brought up this illustration kind of stuff is I was thinking a lot about like the Transformers posters.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And just basic, and actually a lot of the Marvel stuff.
Iron Man poster.
Well, you're talking about like a like comic book, you know, like it's adapted from a comic book. And I personally think comic book covers are, there's a lot of them that really draw your attention and pull you in and make you kind of like want to go towards a title. And I'm like, they have all these fucking designers.
Yeah.
Why don't they just have somebody design that shit?
Well, and how many times do we have to see a poster where somebody's standing in rubble from a city that's been destroyed? And they have to stand there all, like, badass and hardcore with guns out. And, you know, either the girls twisted in a certain direction to do the TNA pose. And,
yeah.
You know, the main hero's in the front and he's got something lit up on him. But it's it's just, I'm so, like, I'm bored to tears with it. And when you see people putting out really phenomenal stuff, you know, I mean, there's so much more to be had in movie posters, I think. And one artist in particular, I don't know if you guys have heard of a guy named Olimos.
No, is he one of those kind of, like, commissioned yes. artists?
And he did work for Iron Man 3, and he's done work for the Avengers and Thor, but he finds silhouettes in really interesting shapes, mm-hmm. and it's so clever that every time you look at one of his posters, you just go, why the hell didn't I think of that? Like, he did one for Thor Dark World, where it was a lightning bolt coming down through the city, and the way that the buildings were laid so close together that you were looking down just a sliver of an alleyway, and when you go up into this big cloud billowing with thunder and lightning, it actually makes the silhouette of Thor's hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see Mjolnir really visibly, but it was done in a way that was really stylistic and interesting. I'm like, man, why? I wish we could use that for mainstream stuff.
Sure. Well, I think the big issue here is that the studios... And this is no surprise. The studios just have no confidence in the public
mm-hmm.
to know what they will and will not see. So they think, stupidly, they think that the only way to draw people, an audience, into a movie via poster is to put the stars front and center to let them know that this is why you're going to see it, is because there's these recognizable faces on it. So they'd have the floating heads, which are usually just lazily cropped in
yep.
with Photoshop, and then, like, a monochromatic background most of the time.
I think the one movie that probably sticks out the most in my mind for this trope is probably Casino.
Yeah.
They have the entire cast on there. They didn't put any background in. It's just pure black.
Yeah.
And then it's just their floating heads that have been kind of fanned out, and then just Casino in that red typeface down below.
Mm-hmm. And that was a long time ago. That was back in, like, 96, 97.
Well, what we're getting into is also, like, I mean, so you kind of have to understand how that works, though, because, I mean, so nobody in the creative field is getting input into how it's advertised. They hand it over to the marketing department, and they do it. And the marketing
yeah.
department, I can tell you from... somewhat experience, not a lot, but from more of my psychology background, they're not paying attention to that. What they're paying attention is specifically, these are the numbers, this is what people are looking for, this is, you know, and they're looking at it from that aspect. But,
yeah.
I mean, looking at it from more of a creative end, yeah, it is, when you walk into a theater and you're looking at all the posters, like, yeah, I would love to see, like, that old, like, painted style back.
Well, did you guys see on Netflix, there's a really great documentary about Drew Struzan and his poster designs for all of Spielberg's movies?
Did you guys watch that? No, I haven't seen the documentary, but I mean, yeah, I was going to say he's probably one of the last that's still doing illustrated posters, and I mean, not very often anymore,
and yeah,
unfortunately.
Really rarely,
but...
and it's a damn shame, too, because there was a scene in that documentary where Guillermo was talking about working with him to do a Hellboy, or no, a Pan's Labyrinth poster.
Mm-hmm.
And the company was like, no, we don't want that. We're just going to do a photo of the Fawn character and all this stuff. And he goes, no, but Drew is such a phenomenal artist and he can really get my vision across with this. And they just kept telling him, no, we're not going to put in the funding for it. So Guillermo actually paid Drew Struzan himself with his own money to make this poster.
Yeah.
And it's just gorgeous. But it's really bizarre, too, because apparently he and... Harrison Ford had never met, and they actually met for the first time in that documentary where he walks in and he's talking to him. He's like, hey, thanks for giving me a really beautiful face with no wrinkles and everything for all of the Indiana Jones films. But it just makes me think more and more about how Hollywood jobs are disappearing because everything is so digital and heavily CG, and there's so many capable artists and illustrators out there that could really get some great work and great buzz off of being a part of marketing in that way.
But what we have seen on the upside of this is that all of these alternative posters and Mondo posters and these kind of things done by these independent artists are getting more work selling directly to the audience via their website or their blog or whatever outside of the studio system.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I remember me, myself, I hated the DVD cover slash poster. Well, no, more so just the DVD cover for Drive, the Nicholas Winding Refn movie.
Yeah.
And I just so wanted something more expressive and something that really kind of mirrors the movie. And then there was this really cool fan design that came out online. It was originally designed to look like it would have been a 1980s VHS tape.
Yeah, no, that stuff is brilliant.
And then he put it up so that you could download it and take it to Kinko's and then slip it into your Blu-ray, which I totally did because I'm that big of a nerd.
Well, you know, considering the movie used Kavinsky to do a lot of the music, I mean, it really had that, like, you know, driving around in Miami in the 80s, just kind of just top down kind of cruising music. And so it fits to go with that visual aesthetic for the poster.
Yeah, and it works. And also, you know, you could talk about, in correlation to how terrible most of these posters are, you look at, like, the incident where that Wolverine poster, for the second Wolverine movie that just came out last year.
Wolverine with the white and black, yeah.
Yeah, and it was made to look like ink paint, and it was kind of a creative, like, strangely creative poster for a mainstream poster.
Yeah, yeah.
It ended up, like, having this huge response from the audience, so much so that they were, like, breaking into, poster racks next to bus stops and stuff like that to steal them, and they had to keep replacing them because they kept getting stolen.
That's kind
of
awesome.
So people want to see these alternative styles of posters.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're creating a strange hunger by not being creative.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool.
It also helps to have a character like Wolverine attached. But
no, for sure. No, those posters were cool, and I haven't seen very many like that for a while.
Well, and considering the premise is that he's in Japan, which is, you know, the birthplace of so many of those Sumi ink paintings, it makes sense that they would go that direction. So I'm really happy they did. And I don't condone, you know, defacing public things, but that is pretty awesome to kind of hear that people were that passionate about those posters.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, like, it was different. You look at it immediately and you'll go, whoa, there's, you know, they didn't just, like, have Hugh Jackman's floating head and then an explosion in the background.
You know? Well, what's funny is I also remember when you posted the Croods poster next to the Star Trek Into Darkness.
It was the exact same design. It was weird.
They've done that so many times, especially there's another trope in posters that happen all the time where it's basically a really, really, really low horizon line almost to the bottom of the poster, and then they have a really massive sky that billows up, and they did that for, I think it was like The Crazies, and then something else that, like, completely, like, The Crazies and this other film were identical in their posters.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, they have those blogs where you can see them all lined up, like, the comedies with the yellow or the white background and just the two actors, and then just a red or white text. Like,
yeah.
And it just goes on for ages how many of those have been made.
You can even just rearrange your entire, you know, Blu-ray DVD collection, and if you were to arrange it into comedy and animation and then horror and thrillers and all of that and dramas, one is going to be all pretty much white spines and the rest are going to be pretty dark.
Yeah. Yeah.
So...
Well, good topic. Yeah. And we might as well just go ahead and get into our main review today, which is X-Men Days of Future Past. Now, Matt, you being a huge fan of the X-Men series, how many times have you read the Days of Future Past story from Chris Claremont?
Claremont, it's kind of strange because he's such a massive part of the X-Men history. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I'm in, like, I'm just totally in love with Claremont's work.
It just wasn't your era.
It just wasn't my era, really, but I've enjoyed Days of Future Past. I own Days of Future Past, and I hadn't really opened it for a really long time, but I kind of chose to go back and reread it just recently before the movie, and I was kind of interested, really, at where X-Men went with the movie. I really enjoyed the film, actually, a lot. And I don't know, there's so much to talk about. And I know Richard's a big comic guy, too, so what did you think?
Well, specifically with the comic adaptation part,
Claremont's Are you really familiar with that story?
With that one? I've read it once or twice. There's this... it's also not of my generation. Specifically, while I think some of those stories are great, they have this, it's almost like a TV kind of thing, where you can go back to the original Chris Claremont, like Frank Miller, like Wolverine run, where they're like, I'm the best at what I do, and they have that whole intro line, where they have to bring it back around and reintroduce you to everything. I'm always like, please just, like, even as a kid, it always kind of bugged me. And so, with that period, like, where there are some great storylines, I think that there are a lot of aesthetic and also weird, just kind of like almost TV
editorial decisions. Yeah, because it was written more serialized back then, like to the point with, you know, it was written so that anybody just jumping on could kind of get a grasp of what's going on. I remember even when I was a kid, which wasn't that long ago, in the early 90s, reading like Spider-Man comics, and they'd have those convoluted as fuck stories, and they would have footnotes.
Yeah,
like they'd be like, you know, he'd make some references like, so I remember the last time we fought, and then it would say, check out Amazing Spider-Man 259.
I'm not gonna lie, I kind of actually miss those ones.
I kind of do too, only because it definitely proves like how crazy some of those and dense some of those stories got that they had to do that.
Well, Days of Future Past, though, it was really interesting, because for a lot of people that may not be familiar with that story, it's basically looking into this like apocalyptic future for the X-Men, and basically, I mean, we're looking at the fact that, like, in the comics, Kitty Pryde basically sends herself back in time, or no, I'm sorry, forward in time. I'm kidding, all mixed up. See, this is what comics do. She sends herself back in time to warn the X-Men that if they play out a certain scenario in the wrong way, it's going to affect the future for mutants and humans altogether. Mm-hmm. Because Bolivar Trask is basically working to eradicate mutants through the Sentinel program. And what ends up happening is there's an assassination attempt that projects into the future where humans sort of decided over the years that mutants were a threat and they needed to be wiped out. So they actually, after this assassination attempt, it sort of, it shot the
anti-mutant sentiment. Yeah,
exactly. It just sort of projected that to fast track it and get mutants wiped out. So basically,
but with the movie, getting into the movie a little bit more.
Specifically,
it builds off. What did you?
I was just going to say that, you know, what are some of the biggest changes here? I mean, obviously, we have Wolverine going back in time now instead of Kitty Pryde.
Yeah, I was kind of getting into that. So, one thing that they have to do in film versus the comics, of course, is when you're adapting it, you have to play towards the actual universe of those superheroes. And I know there's a lot of comic nerds that get you know, kind of fed up with that and don't like it. I only don't like it when they impose a stupider idea, or a stupid idea over a good idea. And within that context, I don't see actually any interpretation issues in this, because we already have so many films that it has to build off of, that trying to build an adaptation specifically through the comic into this world just didn't make sense. Basically, as a film, I actually thought that the plot structure was fine. It was a little convoluted, and at times, like, it really, some of the time travel stuff, I was like, okay. The other thing that I've got to say that I think is pretty unanimous through X-Men First Class and this film is they really need a Joss Whedon to punch up their fucking dialogue, because, oh my gosh, like, there were so many times, like, I was rolling my eyes, because just, like, there's a scene where Mystique pulls in Magneto into, like, this little, like, box thing, and she has, like, a comb or something out of his throat. I couldn't really see what it was, but to me it looked really cheesy.
It
didn't look cheesy. I mean, the dialogue when they're going back and forth was cheesy. And you're talking about two actors who, throughout most of the film, Magneto is one of my favorite parts of these films. Michael Fassbender is just a badass.
And yeah, he steals every scene he's in.
He does. But those scenes specifically, like the back and forth, even how fast the shots were cut, everything about it, just, I was like, this is cheesy and not working. And two. The other thing is they beat me over the head with exposition about the time travel. And I did... That is another thing that I really disliked.
Like, yeah, I specifically had a really hard time with the first third of this movie. In fact, I was kind of hating it for about half an hour.
Okay.
Because it was just like every single conversation these characters had was plot, 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 plot. Well, plot, 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 plot. And it was just like, come on, let's... I mean, I know we're like dropping us in the middle of a very kind of hard to explain thing, but, you know, a little more showing, a little less telling. Like,
well, we had Looper just not too long ago. And I mean, yeah. Yes, it's kind of a throwback to Terminator and kind of that kind of time travel narrative.
Yeah.
And I think audience got it fine, and it didn't seem like they beat us over the head with it.
I think just the way that I kind of took the movie in is like I thoroughly enjoyed it. I will say the beginning was a little clunky.
Well, it just had a lot of legwork to get out of the way because it
did.
I mean, the movie in general, I think, has a lot of tricky things it has to do because it's retconning some of the X3 specifically, but a lot of the poor choices along the way that have been made since Bryan Singer left the series. And now he's kind of trying to wrangle it back together. And it's also trying to recreate this comic book story. And it's also trying to tell a time travel narrative, which is inherently hard to do. So I think the fact that it does, you know, in my opinion, it does manage to pull it together and start getting into character, which is what I wanted from it, by at least midway in the movie, I think... You know, I think it does actually fairly good job.
Yeah, because, I mean, more than anything, I interpreted this movie as such a transitional X movie, because you're going from the trilogy and the Wolverine movies, and they basically, in one film, they have to, like, retcon X3.
Mm-hmm.
They have to pull away a lot of plot lines that they've opened up in other films. Mm-hmm. And they have to get it on track to go into Age of Apocalypse, which that's going to be another crazy story. But they had so much to do in such a little amount of time that I think more than anything, I was just impressed that they were able to handle it in a way where, like, I mean, I thought it was actually a really good movie, but I didn't think it didn't blow me away.
Mm-hmm. No, what?
But they juggled a lot, and I feel like they ended up with a pretty successful film.
So I was balancing out just saying some of my negative takes from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I did actually, I thought all the Magneto stuff worked again. I thought the Charles Xavier stuff worked better this film.
I disagree with you, actually.
Okay.
On this one, with Magneto, one of my complaints that I had about this movie is that, after discussing with friends as well, like, we all kind of agreed that Magneto didn't really have a motive in this movie. Like, before he, in First Class, Xavier kind of unlocked his untapped potential. And he kind of took him back through memory lane and captured how he's able to find that, through Rage and Serenity, he kind of found that power. And in this, now that he didn't really have a motive and he wasn't going on, like, let's go kill any remaining Nazi kick, you know, he just kind of went into it just sort of like, well, what do I do now? I'm just going to kind of drift around and...
See, and I didn't see what I saw his motive as is that basically he'd been locked in prison and... He hated humans. This was his development into that kind of character. Because in the last movie, you didn't really see him until the end kind of break into his classic villain role.
Mm-hmm.
And this is him being a villain again. Even though he's kind of working with the heroes, the whole time he has his own agenda.
I didn't really feel like I found the passion in Fassbender in this one. It just kind of, he felt deadpan to me. And I think it's maybe because what you just said is that he took on his villain role, but I just didn't feel like between Xavier giving up and Eric just kind of...
No, the Xavier...
Existing, it just, there was something there that was kind of hollow in that.
Well, they didn't give him the whole, like, hunting Nazis. This film wasn't as much about him. Like, I still think that X-Men First Class was really... the first draft of that film was the Magneto solo film.
Yeah.
And, So you did get that whole line. In this one, it was just basically he was in prison. They break him out, and he was in a bad place. But no, I still think he was the best part of it. Hugh Jackman was Wolverine again.
Yeah. I mean, and luckily, we were originally concerned that it was just going to be another Wolverine film masking as an X-Men film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that wisely, this movie really, what it does really well is it introduces a lot of characters one by one by one, and the center of consciousness kind of drifts from Wolverine and starts to feel a little bit more like an ensemble film.
Yeah.
By the time we get midway into the movie.
Well, he's just used as a connecting device in a lot of ways. He's not used as a main plot point.
He's basically a cipher.
Yeah.
Well, really. I'm really happy that they allowed Jennifer Lawrence to really kind of make me actually give a shit about Mystique.
Agreed, because I did not like her at all in First Class.
No, and Rebecca Romijn, she just made her so, like, she was like, so you're just this, like, naked chick in a blue bodysuit that's just taking people down because you don't give a crap. But It just, in this, it was this, you could still feel the leftovers from First Class about her truly being like, are you really proud to be a mutant, or are you still trying to hide yourself and do all this stuff, so...
Well, that was one plot hole that they couldn't... I don't think that they could really rectify, is specifically that whole, like, her growing up with Charles Xavier kind of, like, between the First Class and the original trilogy. And I, to be honest, I just started ignoring that because I understand how convoluted and kind of they weren't planning to tie it all together.
I mean, if you try and think too much about continuity with these movies, especially given this movie, which is dealing so much in continuity, you'll just go cross-eyed.
Well,
trying to, like, build bridges across all the plot holes.
As a film, I think it's fine. Like I said, I think the dialogue needed to be punched up, not necessarily the plot. I think the plot works fine.
I think the plot works fine once it gets streamlined. Once we're in the actual 70s... Actually, funnily enough, probably one of the best sequences in the whole movie, and where I really felt like it started to take off as a movie on its own terms, is once they introduce Quicksilver.
Yeah.
Those are some fun sequences and some really creative action scenes. And I think that he was more of a character, like, in and of himself, for as little as he's in that movie, way more than any of those First Class kids.
No, agreed. And one of my secret hidden passions, one of his set pieces, specifically his big set piece,
used
one of my favorite songs to such a beautiful degree. The Jim Croce song, Running Through the Room. I got such a kick out of that set piece. That one was delivered really well. That character was really great set up. And they're going to be bringing him back. So I'm excited, actually. What's funny, too, is that every preview, everything I saw from Quicksilver, I was like...
Yeah, we all did. We all thought it was going to be pretty terrible. I had some other things, too. Just little knickknacks throughout the movie. I really enjoyed, like, one of the things I really wanted to see in this movie was to see Bobby do his ice slide.
Yeah.
And I was able to see that in the beginning. That was just my little, like, Fox Kids X-Men cartoon, like, wishing to see him use his power in such a way. So I was really happy about that. One thing that kind of confused me is when Wolverine went back into the 70s and he went to see Xavier and Beast in the sort of decrepit mansion. He was mentioning, like, well, can we use Cerebro? And they go, yeah, sure. So we're in, what, was it, like, 1973,
4?
Something like that.
Yeah.
So everything is in the 70s, and then they go down into the basement to use Cerebro, and it's this, like, tricked out, futuristic laser light dance room kind of thing, where it's like, this is the, like... That was from the X trilogy that started in present time, and I was like, why does he have all of this tech downstairs?
Well, that was a continuity.
I was like,
that
whoa.
Was a continuity issue, just because. Well, they also talked about him and Eric building it, and it didn't really seem like they were much of friends after First Class.
No, not at all.
So that's why I was like, so he shot him. He got a bullet through his back, and then he's like, "Hey, do you want to come? You know, make this basement with me?" Like, they left out random bits. And to be honest, this film was so full, like, I don't know what they were going to do. I like that they almost did this strange, like, Exiles, because they had Blink and all. Like, I like that I got that kind of idea from them.
Blink was... She's one of my favorite parts of this movie, actually. She looked awesome.
Yeah, I actually really like all the really violent, let's watch these kids die things.
It's definitely the darkest of all of them, as it should be, given the subject matter.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Peter Dinklage, because I think he's really great.
Really? I thought he was okay. There was specifically a scene where he was in a lab talking.
Yeah.
I really, that was another scene where I was like, okay, dialogue needs to be punched up.
I agree with you. Generally speaking, a lot of the dialogue's not that good. Even, you know, in comparison to other X-Men movies that have better dialogue, specifically the first two, which I still think are the best two. But I
don't know. I was a little concerned about Dinklage playing Bolivar Trask because, I mean, let's be honest, we're all going into this movie...
Don't be a dwarfist.
We're all going into this movie with the preconceived notion that he's just going to be Tyrion again. And more or less, he kind of was in a lot of ways, which was a little disappointing because I don't know the exact range that Peter Dinklage has just yet, but he played that, like, stern, strong, you know, I'm going to get my point across kind of thing. And when Tyrion was upset in Game of Thrones, it's really Bolivar Trask in a different outfit, or vice versa.
You see more of his range in Game of Thrones, and they give him more to work with. I actually... The Bolivar Trask thing, I actually thought he was just kind of he was almost an unneeded character. Like, they could have used a striker, they could have used XYZ. There was nothing about him that was particularly unique. Like, they
really, I actually was really caught up in his performance. I thought, given the dialogue that he had to work with, I thought that he managed to really build a character out of it, and I believed him.
Yeah.
I thought he was believable. That's not my thing. I just thought that he could be replaced with anybody. Mm-hmm. Well, although, see, so I did, again, I feel like the negative one in the crowd, but I did like the film, and that's something that I got out of the film that I liked the most, is that they reset everything.
Mm-hmm. And they did it without it feeling cheap or lazy. It actually feels like, for the most part, it works. I'm not going to ignore the fact that they have built themselves in such a narrative knot and tangle that they, you know, it still has its snags here or there if you think about it too hard. But I think that they managed to bridge those two universes, the First Class universe with the original X Trilogy universe, and really kind of brought it all back around in a way that more or less works.
Well, see, the other thing too is like, and maybe it's still headed towards that because we didn't really get a whole lot about so that they're setting up for using the Apocalypse character, which is a huge godlike.
Yeah, the teaser on that's pretty cool.
Yeah, the teaser was pretty cool and it was a good setup. I didn't completely understand him being able to move bricks, but I was like, yeah, it's Apocalypse.
He's powerful.
I'm still angry that they didn't even give him the like weird lines down his lips. That's such iconic thing to him.
Maybe when he grows up, he develops.
I will actually say in this movie, I think the strongest scene for me was when Wolverine, Hank, and Charles, and Eric, they were all up in the plane, and they had that big back and forth about, like, you know, where were you, Charles, with all of the, you know, you let the X-Men die, you let Banshee die, you let Angel die, and all these things, and they got into that big, heated, odd bromance thing that they have going on, and I don't know, I think that scene really worked well, especially given that Wolverine was sort of the referee off to the side that's like, don't look at me, I just work here.
I also, well, it was funny though too because, yes, that was true for a part of it, but there was also a part of it where Wolverine, when Charles Xavier leaves, he starts kind of being a dick to Magneto, and I really like that dynamic that he's like, oh, I know who you are and I fucking kind of hate you, but yeah. So I kind of still like that, and I like that they built on the joke from the last one where they're like, oh, fuck off, that thing. I thought that was fun.
And I think something that both First Class and this movie do really well, they both have issues setting story up and getting to know the characters. But once they do, I think they both have been really good at building up to a climax. And I think the climax in this movie, specifically with the final battle with... the baseball stadium and all of that stuff with Magneto and the president. And I think actually that is a really incredible set piece in all of the X-Men movies.
Well, it wasn't just a set piece either. It felt very operatic and it felt like it had, you know, it had resonance. That's another character.
And there's an emotional stakes in all of the characters involved, whether it be, you know, Magneto or
Beast.
or Raven.
Yeah.
I think that by that point in that movie, I was willing to concede Given the problems up to that point, I was like, okay, yes, I will say this is a good movie. I feel comfortable saying that now.
Yeah, no, simply those kind of like hang-ups I can get rid of really quick. It's not something that really diminishes my movie going experience. I can look at Days of Future Past on its own, and I do think it holds up, and it holds up in a similar way to First Class. Again, another person I really liked. I really like Beast in this film, and even though he's not given a whole lot, I think it adds still to that, to a subplot. On a subplot level, I think they actually balance some of those pretty well. So
I'm hoping, though, just like moving forward with X-Men for me, I'm really hoping that they've really set up some really great positive opportunities for the future films. But I'm just really hoping that instead of getting everybody in through dazzling us with adding more mutants and shifting characters around and everything, I hope they actually just slow it down a little bit and just focus on the characters that they have introduced so we can get to know them better.
Well, yeah. Make it a threat. You make this guy a really big threat. And see, the other thing that I'm concerned about, because one of the big storylines with him is Age of Apocalypse.
Yeah.
And so I don't think they'll go there.
I don't think so either. And at first I was kind of like, oh, I don't know how they're going to set this up. And
it would
I
be way too similar to this.
I thought they were going to kill one of the characters. And so that would set up another alternate timeline, and it was going to be all about trying to figure out timelines. But I'm actually now thinking about it right now. I'm actually glad that they didn't go that route, and they're just going to probably be introducing him as a villain.
Well, we're moving into a territory now where Hugh Jackman has even said he's kind of reaching the end of his time as Wolverine. He's done it for so long now that he's kind of wanting to move on from that role. And we've also got things like the announcement of Channing Tatum coming in as Gambit and all of these other things. So we're starting to look at a big character shift in these films, so we'll see. We'll kind of see where they are, and even cutting Rogue out and then adding her in at the end for like a second.
Well, yeah, the interesting thing too about all that is it can shift in like 1 second because of what they've done. And what I do like the most is with the setup is all those continuity errors, what they've done by brushing them under is saying, okay, we're going to keep all the good stuff and we can just move on from this point.
Yeah.
So
all right, well, let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework now.
Oh, man, I'm so excited to talk about this.
Okay. Now, Richard, you assigned this to me last week.
I did.
A small Australian film from the 70s called Wake in Flight.
Fright.
Wake in Fright.
Yes.
And I'll let you set it up. What's this about?
Yeah, please do, Richard.
So the plot essentially is just about a school teacher that's trying to get to Sydney and so he can get to London. But he ends up in this small town and he kind of ends up getting stuck for a few more days. Now, that's basically all it tells you in the summary of the plot. But what it doesn't tell you is how fucking dark this film gets, one. I mean, you should know because the film is called Wake in Fright. And because some of the pictures, and because it's an Australian film. But what I end up really actually loving about this film is it does remind me kind of the kind of like 60s kind of the 60s art house film kind of aesthetic, where it doesn't give you a straight plot line. It gives you these scenarios, but then it builds on these themes, and this film goes into some dark territories, whether it be about, and what it specifically it gets into the milieu of is it gets into the milieu of being from a small town to me, and so,
well, I'm sort of being the outsider looking in.
Well, it is the outsider looking in, but they don't treat him that way. You know, they bring him in because he's from a small town.
Crikey, would you like another beer? No, I don't need. Well, how about another beer? No.
I loved about that film. I love that first, because there was something that was like really nice, like that small town charming, but then there was something that was really threatening. Like anytime he was like, well, I don't really like one, it was like, no, you want one. And he was like, kind of like, okay. And as it kept going, it progressively got a little bit more aggressive and a little bit more aggressive until the point where he was like, and so when it shifts gears and he ends up, and it insinuates all these things without having to show you it.
Yeah.
Also, the Donald Pleasence character, how insane he is, and talking about how smart he is. And it talks about what a small town kind of is, you know, and how you can get stuck in a small town. And so I've got to say, even though it was dark, there was a lot of things that really resonated. Like, I personally have never done this, but I do know people who have gone out and, quote-unquote, gone bunny bashing. There's a lot of small rural areas where basically there's such a large rabbit population that you literally, they send people out to kill them. And sometimes they send out young men to kill them. And what they did, and so I know people who'd go out in a truck and just drive all around the sagebrush beating bunnies to death.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very similar scene, but with kangaroos. And
a
so
pretty disturbing scene, yeah.
It's disturbing as shit, and I'm glad at the end they give you that, like, that huge warning. Like, it's not even in small print, it's big print where they're like, this was done actually by professional hunters, it wasn't actually done by the actors, and it wasn't in a cruel intentions. But no, it beats you down and makes you feel horrid.
So let me chime in here, because last night I was over here watching Mad Men with Richard and his wife Jackie, and he tells me, okay, so before you come on the podcast, you have to go and do your homework on this movie called Wake and Fright. And all listeners have to know that, like, Richard loves to see me terrified and creeped out. It is his favorite thing ever.
It is.
That's every horror fan's favorite thing ever, because we don't get scared anymore. So the only way that we can feel it is if we experience it through somebody else.
So we went out and got some dinner, and we came back, and then Richard just casually pops in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I personally, horror is pretty much my least favorite genre in movies, period. Mm-hmm. I don't enjoy being afraid. I don't like the adrenaline rush that comes from it. It sits mm-hmm. with me for too long. So Richard kind of left this movie incredibly vague, and he goes, just go home and just watch this movie. It's called Wake and Fright. And I'm like, what is it about? And he goes, just watch the movie. And I'm like, is there, like, mutilation? Is there murdering? Like, what's going on? He's like, just, no, you'll be fine. Just watch the movie. So I watched it this afternoon right before I came over here, and mm-hmm. I actually really, I, like, loved to hate this movie. Like, I can't say that I enjoyed it really at all, but mm-hmm. I loved poking fun at it because there was so much going on that I was like, are you fucking kidding me right now with this? It's so weird. Like, one of the things that I really enjoyed is that throughout the entire movie, it had no idea what kind of movie it wanted to be. You get thrown into this story where you're like, okay, so this teacher is in this small town, and he's not quite understanding what's going on, but everybody's kind of weird, and you're like, I kept getting this, and maybe it's like a 70s style of filmmaking that threw me off.
Well,
but
it's not a genre film. But it's not about plot.
I know, but when you walk into it, it's just every character that comes his way, like the sheriff that keeps going, hey, come on, have another beer, and when he walks away, he grabs his arm, and they start playing this very weird ambient sound to the soundtrack, like,
yeah,
you start getting this vibe that, like, everybody in the town is in on something and he's not.
Uh-huh.
And so I started getting the vibe that I'm like, okay, we're going down this path that it's going to be this, like, thriller-style kind of horror movie where the cop is going to eventually, like, you know, he'll have too much to drink and get thrown out somewhere. So it kind of left me guessing, like, okay, he's in the hotel now, and the lady that's running the hotel is really weird and kind of robotic and, like, I don't know. I was just getting a lot of different vibes from it. And then when it started getting out of control, when he starts hanging out with these guys and he's like, I have no money left. And we're, like, going out killing wallabies. And, like, the doctor is, like, this crazy drunk that's cooking up kangaroo in this shack out in the middle of nowhere. And I'm just, like, no shirt on, kind of homoerotic. I was like,
yeah,
I have no idea what's happening with this film. And, like, it reached a point where, like, in the 70s, too, because I'm a really big soundtrack movie score junkie, mm-hmm. so I pay attention to sound a lot in movies, and they started doing this thing that they do in a lot of horror movies where they do this weird, like, tinkering sound where it's almost like water hitting really tight, tense wires or something. I don't know how else to describe it, but
yeah, or like kind of like if somebody had like an electric guitar and was just scratching the strings.
Yeah, it's like this thing where it's like a build-up, like something terrible is gonna happen. And when he goes outside into the darkness on that first night with this like lady's wife, mm-hmm. who's this total weird, what is her name, like Janet or Janice or something?
No, it's his daughter.
His
it's
daughter.
His
she
wife.
She's like so weird. I'm like, has she ingested an alien that she just put into him? Because they were, like, making out really hardcore, and then he, like, starts, like, coughing up some stuff, and I'm just like, wait, did she transfer something? And then at the end, even, when they were, like, when he was watching the flashbacks, and you see the doctor, like, having sex with this woman, and he's, like, pouring, like, trickling beer out of his mouth into her mouth, and, like, just this weird stuff was going on, and I'm like, I don't know if I'm supposed to think this is a horror movie, a paranormal movie, like... But something was weird going on.
I'm guessing you haven't had a whole lot of dip into that, like, the art house kind of aesthetic
film. And like, even more so, the thing that made me laugh uncontrollably was when they were out in the middle of the night hunting kangaroo, and they get to the point where they're like, man, crikey, these wallabies aren't going down very fast. And I swear, I thought that they were zombie wallaby because they were red-eyed in the light. And he goes out and he starts having a boxing match with a hunting knife to this thing. He's like, and I'm sitting there like, they're zooming in on the claw of one of the kangaroos. I'm like, okay, this is when the kangaroos come back and start, like, furiously murdering everyone.
That does, yeah, no.
I swear that's where it was going, but it didn't go there. And then
it wasn't about that at all. And I have no idea what movie you watched.
No, but, like...
I actually do. Actually...
Am
everything
I crazy
you're saying
that a little bit? Like,
No. Everything you're saying, your description of it is like so unfiltered and pure. You are the best advertisement for what this movie is and how it's trying to make you feel.
Yeah.
I think this movie is purposely doing all the things you're saying. I think that it is supposed to be really ambiguous, and it's supposed to be really kind of confrontational.
Yeah. Like the scene too, when he's walking out, when he goes up to the labor house to try and get some work or something, and they're closed.
Yeah.
He looks up in the town, and they start doing that strange sound effect that I was just talking about, like some tinkering sound, like somebody's about to get murdered or hit, and like a car gets in front of him. Everybody's staring at him awkwardly, and then he looks up. And there's this, like, creepy-ass Santa Claus looking down at him.
Oh, yeah, this is a Christmas movie.
Yeah, it was just this weird cut where you're zoomed into this really intense face looking down at you, and I'm like, okay, this is where the movie is officially going to start getting really weird. Because I originally thought these people were going to start doing a manhunting mission on him, like he's going to go out into the woods and get hunted.
Yeah.
Because everybody wanted to get him drunk or under some weird substance abuse.
Well, but see, there is where expectations come into film. Like,
yeah.
That's why I strongly suggest, like, you shouldn't, like, all of these tropes you're suggesting and you're both talking about are tropes that didn't exist at this time.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. This movie came out in 1971. This even predates Last House on the Left by a year. Of course, I would actually say that this is a really good, if you're looking at savage films from the 70s, that genre, that era, this definitely, I think, falls in line with something like Straw Dogs or something like Deliverance. It has very similar themes, and it's dealing with it in very similar ways.
But it didn't quite go there.
Well, it predates all those.
I think it does. I think it does in a very unique, specific to its location way. I actually really kind of love this movie.
I love it too.
I don't know, maybe I guess I was just kind of confused.
For all the reasons you're confused.
Yeah, because there's just so many moments, like when he first gets into the house and he has way too much to drink, and the daughter is really strange out in the woods and stuff, and or out in the outback and stuff, and he comes inside, and then once he's totally inebriated, you see these like weird flashes, like he's being dragged out somewhere. But he's really just being put out into that shed. But in your mind, you're thinking that was their goal the whole time, to trick him into doing this. Well, so
I also see a lot of parallels to the way that they deal with the tension in this movie, to that kind of Polanski-esque paranoia. I think a lot, we're not necessarily seeing things the way they really are. We're seeing it the way he sees it in his head.
Exactly.
And, there's a lot that's being implied, but we don't know if that's actually happening or if that's just the way he sees it through his judgmental, I'm from a big city, I'm a school teacher, I'm smarter than these people.
To me, yeah, this film wasn't about... You're looking at... Have you seen any, like, David Lynch, any, like, David Cronenberg,
yeah,
any
a little
of that
bit,
kind
yeah.
of stuff? Well, you're talking... There's definitely a style and a voice here, and it's basically suggesting that to me, this was how, again, to me, the whole context of this film was around the theme of trying to escape a small town and trying to get out. But there's so many things that keep drawing you back in. And the fact that he literally, like, he did everything in his, he did everything that he could to escape this place. But then he was still brought back to the same place.
Yeah, that's the moment of horror.
But see,
that is like, I think one of the best moments, and I saw it coming, but when they lift that tarp and he's like, oh god, like that's like Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
I mean, I just feel like if you were really in a position where you really wanted to leave, you would just make it happen. Like, put on your shoes and run, because there were so many times where he kept getting sucked back in. He's like, okay, fine, I'll have one more beer. I'll have one more beer. And then he just turns into a drunk mess like the rest of the guys. And I guess...
Exactly. But that, I think that's all that's very metaphorical. Point, yeah. Because I think it's, you know, it's talking about the sort of the social pressure to seem hospitable and to take hospitality... And it's almost like, destiny is controlling him. He has no control or agency over his life. And it is kind of, taken to an extreme that to a point where it's almost dreamlike. It's not, you're not supposed to take everything 100% literally.
No, there's definitely a dream kind of logic to some of it. And it's not a straightforward genre plot, you know? It's not about that. That's not what the film is trying to portray.
No, so, actually, that's the one thing I really don't like about this movie is the title. I think it's too leading.
I agree.
I think as something a little bit more subtle.
But do you think that's also a part of the time frame, though, too? Because...
Yeah, maybe.
I think... Because, again, something we've been talking about is a lot of those horror tropes, but a lot of these horror tropes didn't exist then.
No, yeah, I mean,
About horror, we're talking, like, right leading up to this period, we're talking about, like, Hammer horror films, which is usually, like, a Dracula something or rather, almost exploitation-y kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like a pseudo, you know, predating that. Or you're talking, and so, this film, to me, is definitely in a body of those kind of foreign films that existed a little bit before this period. And is
but I also see, like, a very strong connection, like I said, to films like Straw Dogs and Deliverance, and even to some extent later on with The Wicker Man, the original. Well, there's that kind of feeling, the fish out of water.
Well, I think thriller. It would be interesting also to look within the milieu of... Australian films,
which I don't know as much about, to be honest.
Well, I don't, but I mean, you can still be like just like things like Mad Max, The Road Warrior. I mean, some of the stuff we watch, even like if we go into like Wolf Creek and the Snowtown Murders, things like that.
Yeah, I actually think Wolf Creek has a DNA background to this.
And so I think that there are. So for me, this taps into that like outback manliness kind of whatever kind of, but I think it can be taken in a much general sense. This is an aesthetic film, not a plot driven film. So I think that's a big difference too. And I don't know. So I guess I don't know some of your film history when it comes to that kind of.
Well,
stuff.
I understand that in a lot of modern films, just with the way that sound effects and scores work and just cinematography. A lot of movies don't trust that the audience really understands what's going on, so you have to kind of get your hand held through a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So when you are watching a modern horror movie, if something scary is about to happen, maybe the music cuts out and then adds the tension to a scene, or like there's a buildup of something, like you know that something's going to pop out.
Or they beat you with it, right.
So in this, I understand that back in the 70s, you're not going to be getting a lot of that kind of stuff, especially foreign film.
Well, again, I think you were too,
and especially the early
70s, to think it was a horror film.
But I felt like there were so many things about it that led me to believe that, because it, again, like I said, everybody out there seemed like they were in on something that he didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many scenes where the camera would cut away, and like when they come back in so when he's gambling and he throws the tokens up in the air, he looks up at the light and he gets all like it shines in his face, but there's like black all around him.
Mm-hmm.
Or like the fact that the cop goes, hey, I know a really good place to get food, and he goes, no, that's okay, I'm gonna go back to my hotel, and he goes, no, you're coming to get food with me, and then they go into this dark room that ends up just being a normal restaurant. And then even with the doctor, when they're in the shack and they come back from being drunk and out of control and the light's spinning around, and that's when he gets taken advantage of. But it's just,
I do think that there is a horror element here, and I think that the movie's aware of that, and I think that it uses horror tropes specifically to lead you into a mental frame of mind. I wouldn't say that this movie is 100% a horror film, and that is the way you're supposed to read it, but I think that it is using those kind of elements to create an emotional response.
Yeah, and
I think this influenced horror to come. Because I actually watching
it's prototypical.
Too, I think, yeah. Well, the thing is too, I think, so in like 2 or 3 years, you do have Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I actually do think that they may have seen this film and pulled things from that perspective.
I just look at that scene, especially, well, I'm just going to call them zombie wallabies because that's really what I wanted out of that scene.
It's a disturbing scene.
It's a disturbing scene when they're driving around, like running them over and shooting them. But at night when they go back out, the way that they set that entire scene up, you're looking at their spotlight looking out into pitch black all around them. And when they spot a wallaby, the reflection in their eyes are red. They start pushing that weird horror sound effect vibe. And then when they get out of the car and they see a dead one laying there, they zoom in on one of the paws. And you're thinking at any point in time, one that's dead is just going to come back and just start ripping a guy apart.
Well, that's because the one thing that I will caution a viewer going into this is if you can't stomach actually seeing an animal shot or killed in any ways, this it doesn't shy away, and this is very realistic. Those little, like, you're talking about the movement, that's actually, when something dies, that's very normal. Like, that's...
Yeah, I know, but it's just in that way where, like, they even had to add that piece of dialogue in there and they go, crikey, the wallabies aren't going down very easy tonight, and you're sitting there going, okay, and then you zoom into a wallaby staring at him with, like, piercing red eyes, and you're like, clearly you're building a tension here, like, the wallabies are going to fight back right now because it's a group of dudes out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, so, I think that's the overall tech of that is, the context of that is to, that there's this, just this overarching sense of hostility,
mm-hmm.
and in both in this event, which he's taking part in, kind of, he's doing it because to be polite, but he sort of feels sick about it at the same time. And again, what we're seeing isn't necessarily what's happening, it's how we're seeing it through his eyes. And, you know, being very inebriated and also feeling very uncomfortable by this whole thing. So I think it isn't a horror film in the sense of Texas Chainsaw, although I think that this movie kind of leads to the furthest extreme expressed in Texas Chainsaw. Agreed. But it is a horror film kind of in a Polanski-ish sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, you're talking more like a Repulsion or something.
Like, yeah, that. More like a Repulsion or like a Rosemary's Baby, that kind of idea of sort of the paranoia film.
I can agree with that. I mean, I think it pulls it back from that a bit more. I think it's kind of more of a drama.
It's a little bit, yeah, it's a little bit more subtle than that even. But I quite enjoyed this movie. But we do got to wrap up.
Oh, for
so
sure.
So I'm going to give you your Netflix homework for next week.
Hold on, one more thing I have to say. Throughout the entire movie, the main character to me, I kept thinking if Benedict Cumberbatch and Dominic Monaghan fused together, it would be that guy. If you look at that guy's face, that's all I could see throughout the entire movie. It was cracking me up.
Maybe it's just the Guy Pearce thing, but I kept seeing... Or maybe it's just the Australian thing, but I kept seeing Guy Pearce. But anyway, next week I'm going to have you watch Otto Preminger's Anatomy of a Murder.
Okay.
Which is quite good, so I'm excited to talk about that. And thank you for coming on, Matt.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Yeah, and dropping in your 2 cents on these films. And before I have to read off a bunch of garbledygook here at the end, where can people find you, either on Twitter or your blog?
Yeah, right now I'm actually setting up my new website, so the best place to kind of find any updates on anything that I do is on Twitter, and I am at Matt, M-A-T-T, _ Grigsby, Grigsby.
All right, awesome. And if anybody wants to email us here and weigh in on any of these movies or any of these topics we've talked about, you can do so at our email, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast, to see any updates about the show or any news items we may not talk about. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio or Pocket Cast and listen to us on your favorite mobile device. When you're at iTunes or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Apparently now Stitcher has this whole thing going on where if you get over 1,400 reviews, it like automatically puts you on a fast search list or something like that. So that would be cool.
Yeah, we've only got like 40 years until that happens, so.
Yeah, sure. You can find our regular archives at our Podbean page, which is jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, where you can also find our RSS feed. You can read the movie reviews that I write every week for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I haven't written the last couple weeks because I was too swamped with homework, but I'm getting back on the horse and I'm going to be writing an X-Men review here pretty soon. You can read the content that I provide for the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can find Richard's writings at his new blog, rdwally.weebly.com. And be sure to check out episode 10 of our nephew podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, at quartercrisis.podbean.com. They just did their first episode where they had to communicate to people through Skype. So,
yeah, take that, Quarter Life. How do you like it?
So we know all what that's about. All right. Until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.